But what criteria are you looking at personally to look for the fall, if you will, capital F, the fall? Meaning, when will this event happen at which people stop believing that fractional reserves are a good thing, or maybe the reserve requirements will go up, or hypothecation would end, which is another phantom way of creating currency, or the central banks would be held in check? Like, is there anything that you're paying particularly close attention to, or is it one of those binary events? You're either in a panic and nobody's accepting your dollar bills at the bodega anymore and they want, you know, that shave of gold, or you're not? I mean, what do you think?
I think it's going to have to be a political solution to what is a political problem, because our currencies are political currencies. I think that's what it comes down to. So it's very difficult for me, or I think anyone else, to try and handicap the catalyst, the event, that the last straw that makes everything come down, or changes the monetary system. I doubt it's going to be an economic release. I doubt it's going to be. You're laughing. Does that mean you discount that?
Just well, I just think that the crowd, generally speaking, is not looking at the economic release. So I laugh at it because I think that's well said. That's exactly right.
It's becoming increasingly easy to be more and more skeptical about their efficacy as it relates to real economies. Other than the optics and the entertainment value that we see on TV and in the press, I think we all kind of know that the economy, as data would have it, is somewhat weaker than it shows, I think, or at least in my opinion. Anyway, I don't know. I think. It probably starts in geographies where there isn't as robust a government infrastructure to deal with issues related to markets and related to consumer prices, and where maybe perhaps that's what we're seeing in the Middle East and in some of the southern European countries. I think it all reverts back to the banking system. We can have civil unrest among the great unwashed that I include myself in, because I can't afford to repay a loan I may have outstanding, or I can't find a job. But I think what it comes down to is a gradual and maybe sudden, I don't know, but loss of power among monetary authorities and politicians globally. And I think they're, one of these days they're going to scratch their heads and get in a room and say, we've got to do something about this because we're losing control.
And I want to focus on that a little. Bob and I looked at instances of severe currency devaluation a couple of weeks ago, and found that they were shockingly more common than we thought they would be. And I wonder if, sort of switching to economic history a little bit, if you could point to a couple things that may be forgotten in sort of the history of exchanging, I don't know, money for things.
This is something that's near and dear to my heart, because it's actually even part of something that we've been doing as an organization called the Future of Finance. And we've been talking how important it is that investors understand economic history as part of their investment knowledge. And I want to get some more of your viewpoints on that.
I think I agree 100%. I mean, There's certainly historical precedent for all of this. I won't go to Weimar. I won't go to all the usual suspects. Weimar Germany, for those that aren't familiar, in 1922, I think it was, had extraordinary inflation where you you know, I mean, the value of the
currency. Wheelbarrows of currency.
To the point, I believe, where, or maybe I'm confusing, it was Zimbabwe a few years ago. But
or
they were
Argentina
only,
right now.
Yeah, they were only printing currency on one side of the bill because it was too costly to print it on both sides. But, I mean, just ridiculous, you know, you'd spend your money in the morning because it wouldn't buy nearly as much in the afternoon, that kind of thing. So, that has happened. What is, and we all know it can happen when there's a loss of public confidence. But for the first time that I'm aware of now, you have all global currencies unbacked by anything, without basis, without not exchangeable into anything fixed or scarce. So in Weimar, if you had any savings at all, you could try and move it into another currency, into dollars. If you were in Zimbabwe a few years ago, you could try and move it into rand or dollars, which they did. If you had any savings at all, you're in Argentina, you know, the peso today, you could try and move it into dollars or something else. However, all the currencies, including dollars these days, are unbacked. So it's become a completely relative game, which raises an issue, a legitimate issue. Does it matter, right? Does it matter? Because if no one else can have a currency that is any better, well, it creates this weird scenario. And I'm tangentially going astray. The question is about history, but I think this is important because it doesn't really relate to history. There's a couple scenarios I can envision. The default becomes the dollar, which is today's gold. In theory, I mean, you could make. Because, you know, Bretton Woods was, you know, you could convert your currency into dollars, which would be convertible into gold at $35 an ounce. When that broke down in 71, officially in 73, the dollar became the new currency, only remaining reserve currency. So you just wanted to know your exchange rate to dollars above all else. So what happens when the Fed starts printing like a banshee? Here's the interesting thing, I think. If you're producing energy in the Middle East, or you're producing goods and services in Asia, and you've been exchanging your scarce resources, or your natural resources, or your human resources, your labor, for these paper claims on something that is absolutely unreserved and abstract, and you're holding them, and you're China, for example, and you've got $3+ trillion in dollar reserves, and you look out and you say, well, I think the future purchasing power value of this $3+ trillion might be, let's say, $500 billion, or something less than $3 trillion. You're going to say, huh, we need to convert this stuff into actual resources, into something that is into production.
It's funny, by the way, you mentioned this, because I was going to ask you, when I had asked you the criteria question, what about an event of the various oil-producing countries? This is exactly one of the things I'm paying closest attention to, is most people don't know that oil reserves exchange and are bought and sold with the U.S. dollar, almost exclusively globally.
Petrodollars,
exactly. And what happens if OPEC basically says, you know what, it's been great. We've had a really wonderful relationship since, you know, just after World War I, first with the English and now with the U.S. But we're really going to end that relationship with the West. We're going to create our own currency that you have to buy in order to buy our oil.
Well,
I mean, that could be your
event.
So, yeah, Bitcoin's
gone. So a skeptic might say, are we bringing this up 15 years too late, or was this actually done many, you know, a few years ago? And I have no idea, you know, I don't want to go there, but you know, suddenly we've been in Iraq, in Libya, and possibly Syria or Iran, or and so we are placing ourselves in the Middle East in the midst of all that. So what happens if a natural resource producer balks at taking paper claims? I don't know, he says.
But
we don't like that.
That's different than the unwashed, which is why it maybe has more credibility as
that's
a
right.
theory, though. Because,
that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't know. And I don't pretend to even know. So,
yeah.
So, but it's there. And at the end of the day, if I'm a powerful person, which I'm not, but if I am, all I care about is resources. Nothing's changed over millennia. Right? I want access to them. Price doesn't matter as long as I have access to it. I can always set the price, or the market can set the price, but the important thing is access to productive resources and natural resources. And if that's jeopardized, perhaps because the currency we're exchanging it for comes into question, well, you know, there might be ways around that.
This is off tangent too, but the fact that we have these currencies that are baseless, is that, do you think that has anything to do with why people are starting to accept these digital currencies we've been talking about? This is something we've been talking about a lot lately, you know, Bitcoin and all these things that are out there. I mean, they're becoming an investment vehicle, and there people say, well, there's nothing backing that. Well, there's nothing backing the currency that you have in your pocket either, so.
That's true. Except, you know, years of precedent and socialization and
sure, which
we're
is
used
still,
to it,
yeah, which is what's keeping
curve and acceptability.
Yeah, which is what's keeping it from becoming a, you know, usable currency now, but you know, it's a matter of time or not.
If it's a one in, and I'm going to make these figures up, if it's a 1 in 10 chance that we go back to some, you know, hard currency, gold-backed currency in some amount, you know, 100%, 50%, 20%, 10%, whatever it is, if there's a 1 in 10% chance, and I'm not saying, I think it's probably better than that, but let's say that there's probably a, that means that monetary authorities accept that, let's say, they have to accept gold as a basis for a currency going forward because everyone else has lost confidence in the fiat currencies they're printing. I would say there's 1 in 500,000 chance that monetary authorities accept digital currencies. You know, I would doubt it. Which is not to say they can't work on their own, but you know, gold as a monetary asset has precedent, and it's not. It's not a statement of anarchy, because it would have to be every type of monetary system has to be politically accepted, or else it can't work.
Yeah.
I know, over time, you know, mm-hmm. It has to be accepted by, you know, the tax collectors. It has to be accepted, and so on and so forth. When the IRS collects bitcoins in return for your income, you know, I just don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, we've already seen Thailand, make it illegal. So,
but having said that, I think that Bitcoin is a real and viable alternative currency. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's made illegal, like it was, and in the United States and everywhere else, because it is absolutely in direct competition with the power base of governments, of the state. So,
that's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this talk of alternative currencies, I'm going to quote you to you, if that's okay. You mentioned in a report, our currencies are moving targets, and therefore the secular value of everything cannot be accurately judged, which is provocative for me as sort of an underpinning of this whole conversation is that, you know, as we discuss the, you know, pivoting from one standard to a gold standard, I mean, is what we're really looking for to just sort of solidify things so that we then can accurately assess value. Is that...
boy, whoever said that's really smart. I think, you know, where it kind of hits home for me, this whole concept is, you know, I made the case, and I'm not, you know, everyone knows this, that price is not necessarily value. There's a price, and then there's value. It's what we all value things at. But, I mean, value can be for a good service asset, an hour of our labor, whatever it might be. But it really comes down to the values of society, what we're, and I'm not going into any, you know, mealy-mouth kind of a sermon here at all. But there's no way to escape. I wouldn't be surprised if it's made illegal like it was and in the United States and everywhere else, because it is absolutely in direct competition with the power base of governments. The state. So,
that's a good point.
Well, I mean, this talk of alternative currencies, I'm going to quote you to you, if that's okay. You mentioned in the report our currencies are moving targets, and therefore the secular value of everything cannot be accurately judged, right? Which is provocative for me as sort of an underpinning of this whole conversation, is that, you know, as we discuss the, you know, pivoting from one standard to a gold standard, I mean, is what we're really looking for to just sort of solidify things so that we then can accurately assess value. Is that...
boy, whoever said that's really smart. I think, you know, where it kind of hits home for me, this whole concept is, you know, I made the case, and I'm not, you know, everyone knows this, that price is not necessarily value. There's a price, and then there's value. It's what we all value things at. But, I mean, value can be for a good service asset, an hour of our labor, whatever it might be. But it really comes down to the values of society, what we're, and I'm not going into any, you know, mealy-mouth kind of a sermon here at all. But there's no way to escape that it's what we value, our time. Do we value a third home or a second home as much as we value, I don't know, you know,
Plumbing,
right? I mean, or as much as we value the opportunity to have a job where that we can go every day and be productive and have a sense of comfort that we're going to have the job tomorrow. You know, we're making these value choices, sociological value choices that we see. I mean, it's very clear. You know. We're seeing a widening of wealth and income gaps, dramatic widening of wealth and income gaps, because those close to the center of credit that have access to assets are getting wealthier on paper, or seem to be getting wealthier, as central banks are printing more and more money, to Copernicus's, you know, point. And yet, the real economy, the labor economy, the productive economy is falling off. And we see it in the daily headlines every day. It's what's happening in Detroit. It's what's happening everywhere. And this makes anyone looking at this discussion from a political point of view, it makes their head explode, because, you know, it's coming from a person that would prefer to see a currency that is exchangeable into something with you know, more concrete, talking about widening wealth and income gaps. But it's not a political issue at all. It comes down to the values that we are placing on our society. So what we're seeing is this widening wealth and income gap. Is it sustainable? I suppose, but not, I don't think, for much longer.
Yeah, where's the historical precedent of that lasting forever? There isn't one. Usually there's a revolution before that happens. And, I mean, you didn't say it, I said it, but
some of the data is pretty alarming and shocking.
Well, it is, and so I'm not calling for a revolution. I think you're right. There's a history of social unrest and poor response by the state, by politicians. Unlike a lot of people that sit in my chair arguing for harder currency and fixed exchange rates, I think that policymakers, that monetary authorities, are actually smart. Or the people that are directing them are smart. And there is a plan B in the drawer somewhere. And they'll pull it out when things get too squirrely. And they'll say, okay, let's, instead of monetizing debt, let's monetize gold. We'll devalue the dollar to gold. Let's call it $10,000 an ounce, something huge. The process of printing the money to tender for the gold that you'd attract at $10,000 an ounce is the process of inflation, and that's the process of delevering the economy. Bang, it's done. Obviously, the winners and losers, the losers are fixed income holders, savers, anyone saving in dollar terms or any other currency terms. Because I have a feeling if the Fed were to do this, then everyone else would have to do it just on the back of it. And I have a further feeling that it wouldn't be a surprise to anyone else, any other monetary authority anywhere in the world. So winners would be, we think, asset holders or holders of unlevered assets. And that's how I think historically you've gotten to precious metals and natural resources. It's not that they're good inflation hedges. It's that they're good deleveraging hedges through inflation.
Which is what the argument is from a lot of people right now about why you should be buying gold, right? A lot of people out there saying, if this happens, even though you have to decide what the probability of this happening, but if you do a scenario analysis, that's how you can get to gold prices that are considerably higher than what they're trading at today.
My partner at Cubamco, which is the firm that we're rolling into Copernic, that's kind of a tongue twister, but Lee Quaintance and I came up with a metric to try and find an intrinsic value of gold, which has been the biggest knock against gold. How do you value it? It has no
income
interest. It doesn't do anything. It's an inert, shiny rock. It's a, why have it at all? What we did, and we didn't, this was not terribly creative either. We looked at the Bretton Woods system, which was the post-World War II monetary system that ran from 1945 to 1973 officially, that took base money, it's M0, under Bretton Woods. And it's interesting. If you do look at a long chart of CPI, a long graph of CPI, you see, CPI inflation, goods and service inflation, was very tame up until 1971, 72, 73.
Yeah.
And we know that. We know what happened in the 70s. It started to take off. Well, why? Well, I think we know why, right? Because suddenly the currencies had no base. It's pretty straightforward, I think.
Well, I just got Jan de Vries' excellent book, Europe in a Time of Crisis, which focuses on 1600 to 1750, where he talks about the cost of a day of skilled labor being one guilder a year for 50 years in Amsterdam. But another very, very far ago historical period that's interesting is when the Romans started devaluing their metal-based currency, sort of coincident with the beginning of the retraction of that empire. And they just sort of started putting less gold in the coins. It used to be that if you got a coin, a gold coin, it would have an ounce of gold or whatever the value is, and there was a quarter and an eighth and a sixteenth and so on and so forth. And if it's just this arbitrary exchange system that's centralized, what are we talking about here fundamentally? Is it a reset from a period of lack of discipline to a new period, and then we can sort of, it's a new beginning when we can, you know, sort of start sinning again as the Romans did and stuff like that? What is the defense mechanism in the future from you know, additional periods of excessive evaluation?
So I think that there will, at the end of the day, this is going to be a phenomenal trade. If you own unlevered assets, or in the case of gold, I think delevered assets, because they're going to outperform, and I don't want to make investment recommendations. That's the last thing I'm doing here. But I think if this were to occur, they would greatly outperform. And your question, I think, goes to what then? What happens then? My sense is that the political dimension will not change. They're just, the currency system will change. And it won't probably change as much as the perception of it will change. Yes, we'll be linked somehow to gold, let's say, but there will still be fractional reserve lending. Once we've delevered and we have winners and losers in the economy, banks and everyone else will also be delevered and will be ready to lever again, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the skeptic in me says, are you supposed to, you know, if you're holding, for example, gold at $1,300 an ounce and it goes to $12,000 an ounce, are you supposed to hold on because, you have to take a look at it, but I don't think that it's necessarily true that you're going to have to hold on to that. I think there might be a better trade at that point in levering up yourself as an investor. Go back into financial assets that have gotten crushed, relatively, not in nominal terms, but in real terms, versus real assets.
And that's a neat transition to sort of talking about, you know, value investing in the present day, which is, you know, if we believe that runaway inflation is coming, wouldn't we seek companies with very levered balance sheets that, you know, that will come to be under less stress as they can repay with devalued sort of claims?
I don't think it's that obvious, no, because there's a few things at work here. One is whether or not they're term funded, or whether they're going to have to refinance.
Mm-hmm. There's a bullet
during this whole period. So if they're term funded and their businesses are reliant on demand from consumers or businesses that have to borrow to purchase their goods or services, then it's not that straightforward. So if we're to invest in an equity, in an operating company, your mind in this scenario goes to consumer staples rather than consumer discretionary, right? You might not buy a Porsche or the higher end stuff if you have to borrow, but you're going to obviously have to buy your daily needs, regardless of price. And I'd like to bring up, and this is as it relates to operating companies, I think the biggest endorsement of this theory that I'm espousing is, ironically, Warren Buffett, who over the last 50 or 60 years has bought nothing but brands, as we know, or operating businesses that make money on the inflation trade. It's very interesting, actually. Insurance is all about inflation. You have fixed benefits and continually rising premiums, which obviously do very well as price goes up through inflation. You have Coca-Cola and Gillette. It doesn't matter if a can of Coke is a nickel or $5 or $50, it's going to retain its margin because it has that brand loyalty. Everything he's owned, if you look at his portfolio, absolutely is an inflation play. Alternatively, things he's passed on, including his best friend's business, Microsoft. You know, technology is a deflationary business model. It drives prices lower. They continually have to innovate new products, or else the nominal price of their product is going to go lower. Yeah. And it's good. It's efficient. That's the way economies should work, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. But that isn't an inflationary model. So I think you know, if you think that there's going to be a reversal in expectations towards disinflation, what consensus thinks now, towards the expectation of rising inflation, I think the best possible portfolio to have would be to take a look at, you know, brands and consumer staples and things that are inelastic to price. And that goes back again to value. You know, it's all about value.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you so much for coming.